silence is commanded.
Come along, folks. Come along. You remember that? Please be seated. Before we begin today, my notes tell me we have some students from the STEM Institute. Are they here? And if they are, would they please stand up? Very good. Well, thank you very much for joining us. Now, the students are here. Today, a student is here in a program we run in coordination with the court with class. Have you had an opportunity to have the materials sent to you in advance? Very good. Okay, so they have some idea about what you're going to be arguing about today. And I don't know if you had a chance to hear Justice Dallet after the second argument this morning. Did you have a chance to stop in? Oh, wonderful. So you've done a great job. Good, very good. Okay, so with that little bit of housekeeping out of the way.
From the STEM Institute, what's that?
Mm-hmm. Okay, the third case of the day, then, I will call State versus Friedlander. Counsel, are you ready to begin?
Good afternoon. My name is Jake Whitmer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Criminal Appeals Unit at the Wisconsin Department of Justice. May it please the Court. Zachary Friedlander was mistakenly released from custody. The state discovered its error, and Friedlander sought 65 days of sentence credit for time at liberty. The Court denied his request, and the Court of Appeals reversed. It concluded under Risky and Dentici that credit was due because Friedlander's liberty was at no fault of his own. The state now asks this court to issue a decision that accomplishes three things. First, and most importantly, disavow the Court of Appeals through no fault of the offender rule in Risky and Dentici, and direct courts to evaluate all claims of sentence credit under 973-155 and, as relevant here, Magnuson. Second, reject Friedlander's request to adopt Risky and Dentici based on equitable principles. And third, reverse the Court of Appeals and conclude that Friedlander is not entitled to the credit under 973-155 because he was not in custody under any commonly accepted definition of the term and not under the definition that this court announced in Magnuson because he was not subject to an escape charge for leaving his status of being at liberty. Turning to the first point, it's an accepted principle that where the legislature adopts a comprehensive statutory scheme, that the court's role is to interpret that scheme, not to graft on new remedies onto it. That's precisely what the Court of Appeals did here in Risky by adopting a federal common law rule from decades earlier that was not a part of Wisconsin's common law. This rule is, in addition to several cases that announced this rule, it's also implicit in 93910, which is the short statute that says that common law crimes are abolished as of the adoption of the criminal code in 1955, but that criminal law rules are preserved to the extent that they are not contrary to the new statutes. And here, the rule that was in Risky. And the Risky decision itself does not mention 973-155 at all, even though the statute had been in effect for more than 10 years at that point. That is contrary to the statute, so the state urges this court to overrule it. In addition, sentence credit is confusing enough, I think, for judges, for courts. Having clear rules, as this court announced in Magnuson, benefits the parties, it benefits the courts, and adopting piecemeal common law rules in addition to the statute is inefficient and leads to unpredictable results.
Counsel, I was looking at one of the law review articles cited. It is a 1996 article. That's a while ago now, over 20 years ago, entitled Getting Out of Jail Free Sentence Credit for Periods of Mistaken Liberty. And at that time, 22 years ago, it indicates the number of circuits, federal circuits, Court of Appeals that have adopted this equitable principle, and certainly most of them have. And it goes on to say, and only a handful of modern cases reject the doctrine. So, I haven't personally done a state-by-state analysis, although I read the Roach case out of the Washington Supreme Court. Updates numbers a bit. Why shouldn't we do that? Why should we be one of only a handful of the modern cases that reject the doctrine?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, it's not clear to me, first of all, that that the rule is so universally accepted. I think that once you take a look at the facts of individual cases, there are strong arguments that fundamental fairness in individual cases might require the granting of credit in a particular case. But even if we do accept for a moment the premise of the article that it's become the accepted rule, that's not surprising in the federal courts because this rule was announced long before the adoption of any sentence credit statutes, federal statutes. It was announced in 1930 in White v. Perlman. And apparently the courts have, the federal courts have determined that that it survives the statutory enactments that have come along the years after through 1984. And so it's not surprising to me that a law review article might come to that conclusion. But here, Wisconsin has adopted a statute, a comprehensive statute in 1978, that defines what custody constitutes. And nearly all cases deciding whether a person is entitled to credit look to whether the person is in custody or it's in connection with the course of conduct for which the person is to be sentenced. And that, I think, is where the analysis always needs to begin, where the legislature has made an announcement. Regardless of what other jurisdictions have decided to do or how they've arrived at their law.
Do you think that we need to overrule both Risky and Dentisi? I mean, I guess the question is Dentisi distinguishable at all because of its probation?
I think they're both conditional jail time, condition of probation. So in that sense, this case is like Dentisi. But arguably, this case is different in that there were no conditions that were imposed on Friedlander's release. I mean, he was mistakenly released, so there's no opportunity to impose any conditions. And that's probably the strongest argument for there not being anything for him to escape from. So until a day before the hearing, he's told that he's to appear at this December 1st hearing. He doesn't know even that he's supposed to report anywhere. So I don't think that you can say that there's anything for him to escape from. It would be difficult to prosecute Friedlander for escape if he did something that would be a violation, say, of his rules of probation or of extended supervision. But there were just no conditions on his release. So in Dentisi, there was a condition. He couldn't leave the state. So if Dentisi had left the state, arguably, maybe, he could have been charged with escape. So it's distinguishable on those grounds. But I would argue not though, because of the statute that they're relying, that Dentisi relied on. That statute deals with people who are temporarily outside of the jail. And here, I think it's difficult to argue that a person is temporarily outside of the jail if they've never set foot in it. And that's the situation in Dentici. I mean, you can imagine the circumstances in which that statute was adopted to deal probably most classically with Huber, but other situations as well. So I think that Dentici, Risky also is, I think the facts of Risky are similar in that he never set foot in the jail. And for that reason, in addition, Risky, I don't think that he had any conditions of release imposed on him. There's none in the record. There's nothing in the record to say that he couldn't leave the state. So I don't think that he could have been charged with escape. Could have been charged with escape maybe if he had left. Well, he didn't report. Those are the facts of Risky. He didn't report, and so he tried to claim credit for the whole time, but he didn't get credit for the time they didn't report. And
are you arguing he wasn't subject to a conditional confinement order under 973-094?
He is subject to a condition. I'm sorry, could you...
973.09, paren 4, paren.
I think if your point is that a person, whoever... Friedlander argues that anyone who is subject to an order of confinement is in custody, but looking at the language of the statute, it says custody includes being subject to an order. But that's sort of circular. I mean, I think you need to be able to define what custody is before you can get to saying that that particular statute says that anyone at any time that's subject to an order is in custody.
And you're going to define custody to be?
Custody is under Magnuson. It's a 20-year precedent, nearly 20-year precedent of this court that says that, unanimous precedent that says that a person who is subject to an escape charge for leaving their status is in custody.
For purposes of sentencing credit.
For purposes of sentencing credit, right. I just wanted to return to Justice Abrahamson's point here. Looking at 946.42, the escape statute, 1, sub A, sub 1, sub H, custody of a person subject to confinement under 973.094, the first line says, custody includes without limitation all of the following, and then custody of a person subject to confinement to a confinement order under 973.09. My point is that the fact that the person is subject to a confinement order doesn't define the fact that they're in custody. Custody still needs to be defined under that statute.
Why shouldn't we just say, look, he didn't do anything bad when he was left out. He didn't ask to be left out. They let him out. They gave him the keys to the jail. I don't know that you should ask anyone to say, oh, you made a terrible mistake. I don't deserve these keys. Take them back. I'm going to stay here. I like your food. It's warm. It's going to snow soon.
Only in Wisconsin.
Well, he was in Wisconsin, right? This jail was in Wisconsin. We could put him in Miami. I'll go with him. So here he is in jail. They let him out. We agree that it's silly to say he shouldn't take the keys, right? He should go.
Well, the rule...
The
rule is that a person is entitled to credit when they're absent from custody through no fault of their own.
Right.
The state concedes that the release itself was through no fault of his own. But we have factual findings from the trial court that say that he was at least partially responsible for his being on the lam outside of after his release. He was fully aware that, again, these are trial court findings. This is one of the problems with the Court of Appeals decision. I didn't really harp on this in the brief because it's really not part of our objectives here in requesting review in this case. But the Court of Appeals, I think, also erred in not accepting the factual findings of the trial court. Trial court found that he was partially responsible for his being at liberty. He makes much of the fact that he reported to his probation agent, but his probation agent's advice was, it's up to the judge. And his response to that, as the circuit court found, was not to petition the judge and find out what his status was, when in fact he knew what the status was because it was gone over several times at the hearing, that in fact that he was going to have to serve an additional 2 or 3 months in custody. So in addition, regardless of whether this court would fashion a rule like this, ultimately the legislature has decided what the remedy is by adopting a comprehensive statute. And
by adopting what?
A comprehensive statute that is...
And where does he fit in this comprehensive statute?
973-155.
Which says...
Well, the first sentence of 973-155, from which most of the case law derives, is, a convicted offender shall be given credit toward the service of his or her sentence for all days spent in custody in connection with the course of conduct for which sentence was imposed. So the question here in this case is whether Friedlander was in custody. And we would argue that he was, not under any commonly understood definition of the term, he was not. He was at liberty. But under this court's definition of custody in Magnuson, he was also not in custody because he couldn't have been charged with escape. So, I mean, I think for this court to reach a different result in this case, it would need to, I mean, to affirm the Court of Appeals, it would need to define in custody differently. But I think that...
How should we define it?
I'm not asking you to define it.
Oh, you want it to define the same so that...
If he
doesn't do what he's told, he's an escape.
Right. I think it would require the courts come up with a new rule for cases like this based on a definition of in custody. And I don't think it's possible to read in custody that broadly. I don't think that you could say that he was in custody. I think the rule in Magnuson actually is quite broad. In that it allows for determinations of persons in custody to be in custody even when their level of restraint is not necessarily what we normally consider to be custody.
What about a new rule that says the defendant should receive credit for time spent, quote, at liberty through no fault of his own? The at fault is to the liberty, not the original deed, of course.
Sure.
Whether the defendant could be charged with escape, whether or not the defendant could be charged with escape for leaving his status.
That's essentially the rule that exists right now. But I don't... So you're saying that that's what in custody would mean in this particular situation?
Maybe I just really misunderstood what she said, but I did not think that would... Then you agree that he gets custody.
We would receive credit for this, that he's at liberty.
Through no fault of his own, he's at liberty, so he gets credit. Being in custody is basically what...
That's the existing rule. That's existing rule.
Under
the thing that's different.
That's the existing rule, that if you're at liberty through no fault of your own, you get credit for being in custody.
You get sentence credit. And the Dentici decision tried to square it with the statute, tried to square it with Magnuson and the statute to say that the person meets the definition of custody in Magnuson.
So if you're on probation and you're at liberty, You get credit for being in custody even though you've never spent a single day in jail?
Well, that would be wrong.
Right.
It's also against the statute, too, because the statute says that a person who is just on probation, on regular probation or regular supervision, cannot be charged with escape for leaving that status. You could have a violation, or you could have maybe a new criminal charge, but you couldn't be charged with escape for violating a rule of probation or violating a rule of supervision.
Is there a rule in the federal system that you think is worth anything?
My research suggested that the rule is that it's not nearly as uniform as that law review article suggested that Justice Bradley mentioned.
Uh-huh.
Martinez, which is cited in my brief, 837 Federal 2nd, 861, 1988, it notes that the original common law rule was that a person had to serve all of their time regardless of whether there was a mistake by the jailer or by the state. So no matter how much time had passed, no matter what the circumstances were. And then White v. Perlman comes along in 1930 and says that where the mistake is the state's, the person doesn't have to serve the time from their release. They're entitled to credit for that period. But more recent cases, however, particularly those that look for whether there's a fundamental unfairness, whether there's a violation of due process, a number of courts, federal courts, have examined cases that way and determined that that's ultimately the test that should be applied, is whether making the person under the totality of the circumstances come back and serve that time, if it was a violation of due process, whether it would be fundamentally unfair.
Can the state ever waive its right to assert custody over a defendant who was released under similar circumstances for 4 years? And all of a sudden the state figures out, oh, this guy should have been in. So now he's got a good job and he's doing a bunch of other things.
Right.
Can the state still exact it's 75 days here total that he had to pay?
Sure. No, I mean, I think that should be evaluated, and these cases generally should be evaluated under due process. And so I would argue that 4 years is an awfully long time when you're talking about a relatively minor offense of bail jumping with a relatively short sentence.
Well, let's just say it's not a relatively minor offense. Let's just say for whatever reason, he had 75 days to serve, and it was for something more significant than bail jumping. That was just what was left over for whatever reason because of the way the court put together the sentence. My concern is the timeline. Here,
sure.
The time is not long.
Yep.
But I don't know that I would view these facts similarly if the time had been like 4 years.
I don't think that I would view them the same way either.
Okay.
I think that's a close call, much closer call under constitutional constraints. The state of Ohio in Zuckau, which is not in my brief, so I'll give you the cite.
Yeah.
It's 82 Ohio 3rd. 215. It's a 1998 case from the Supreme Court of Ohio. And in that case, they decided that under facts that are very similar to this case, where a person was mistakenly released, that the person was out for 6 years before the state came back to try to enforce the sentence. And the court determined that coming back more than 5 years later would constitute a violation of due process. So
they
came up with a clear rule there and determined that the state could not execute the sentence in that case.
So even if Magnuson were the rule, the defendant would still have the option of arguing that it violated due process rights.
That's right, yeah. And I think that's certainly, that's the argument that's available, I think, under the circumstances, because again, where the legislature has come up with a clear statutory scheme, the court can't graft common law remedies onto that.
So are you persuaded that the court can do that despite the statutory scheme?
I find that it's a violation of due process?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, the court has the authority to do that, of
yes,
course.
I know, but why should we find it it's against due process when the legislature said keep them in for 5 years?
So you're saying that there's a sentence of 5 years?
Yeah. And they mistakenly let them out. I don't care if it's a discretionary five or mandatory under a statute or the court order. So they let him out by mistake.
Well, I think that if it's a more...
And he's good.
Right. If it's a more...
Have 5 years pass. We could have 10 years pass.
I think if it's a more serious case with a longer sentence, then that is relevant to the due process analysis, which I guess would argue against the approach that the Ohio Supreme Court took. But nonetheless, I think that it's relevant if you have a Class B or a Class C felony and a long sentence, that the longer the period that the state has waited to execute the sentence, by mistake, of course, because I think we're dealing with a different circumstance if it's not by mistake. The due process also protects prisoners from arbitrary uses of power by the state.
Where do you get that? Just from the concept of due process?
It's from case law, which is cited in my brief.
Yeah, but where did they get it from?
Where did they get it?
Yeah, they made it up.
I think it's black letter law that arbitrary and capricious exercise of power by the state, people are protected from that.
What's so arbitrary and capricious about saying, look, they let you out by mistake, you're back in?
I think when you're dealing with only here about 2 months, 2.5 months, I don't think it's arbitrary at all. I think it recognizes that, when the state fails by mistake in its exercise of ministerial duty, the defendant shouldn't receive a windfall. I see that my red light is up.
Yes, and just in time. Well, there you go.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Thompson, and I represent the defendant appellant, Zachary Friedlander. In Wisconsin, the judicial branch is tasked with sentencing and sanctioning a convicted defendant. And the executive branch is tasked with enforcing and administering that sentence or sanction by the court. The core issue in this case is actually a very simple one. Aside from any discussion about in custody, 973155 or Magnuson, the issue is really when the executive branch errs in its duty to administer a court's disposition, who should bear the brunt of that error?
What brunt of the error occurred in this case?
Well, Your Honor, what occurred in this case was that Mr. Friedlander, at the time that he was sentenced in April, had an expectation of 8 months. 8 months meaning he's going to be subject to the direct control and custody of the state. He was wholly compliant with the state throughout that time period, and he served 165 days at that time. Through no fault of his own, then, he's released. And his expectation of 8 months from April actually extends to 2 years ago to this day. Through no fault
not,
of his own,
but,
however...
But not in custody, right?
Well, under Risky and Dentisi, his sentence continues to run.
Well, I know, but I think what you're telling me, though, is that the brunt of the error is that he was free.
He was free for that period of time, Your Honor. But
how is that a brunt of an error?
Well, the brunt is actually what happens after the fact, then. So he's ordered back into jail, has an expectation of December 11th as his date out, And then he's ordered back into jail for another 2+ months.
Right. But his reasonable expectation after sentencing was that he would spend X number of days in custody, right?
Right.
Okay. And that is the amount of time that he has spent in custody, yes?
Can you repeat the question, Your Honor?
Yeah. The amount of time that he has actually spent in custody, in jail, is the amount that he was told that he would spend in jail when he was sentenced.
Your Honor, if I can tweak that slightly, to the extent that it's a period of time, it's less about the actual 8 months and about this is when the court issues its sentence or sanction. This is how long you are subject to the control of the state. And when he's wholly compliant with the directives of the state, regardless of whether or not he's in custody, the brunt is that he shouldn't then have to spend extra time in custody after the fact when all he does is a sentence.
Where's the extra time that he spent in custody?
From December 11th until he was released in February of 2017.
Yeah, with all due respect, I don't think you're really answering Justice Kelly's question. You're talking about a date certain when he's done with this and it's finished. Justice Kelly, I think, is asking you about quantity of time,
yeah.
Days, weeks, that
so,
kind of thing.
Exactly. Thank you. That's good clarification. So he was sentenced to a specific number of days, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And he actually spent that number of days in jail.
I think that would be the state's position.
Well, okay, so this is just a question. So let's set aside technical definitions of custody and non-custody and all that for just a moment, and just help me actually understand the facts on the ground. In jail and out of jail, we can figure that out pretty easy, right? You know, you're either in or you're out, yeah? Okay, so did he spend the number of days in jail to which he was sentenced?
No, Your Honor, but, well, I apologize, Your Honor. In total, he was in actual confinement for 240 days.
Okay, and is that the number of days to which he was sentenced?
He was sentenced to 8 months conditional jail time, which is approximately 240 days, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so what you're concerned about is not the amount of time that he actually spent in jail. What your concern is, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that that amount of time got split up.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So in that period of time in which between the times that he spent in jail, he was free.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. How is that the brunt of an error?
Well, I think that it's twofold. It's that once he's released, again, he's wholly compliant with what the state directs him to do. And so in that time...
All right, so let's take this... let's just slow this down so I can follow your analysis. So he gets released from jail. Actually, it was prison, right? He's released from prison.
Yes, at this point it was prison, okay. Your Honor.
So he gets released from prison, and he knows at that point that he's got additional time to serve, right?
That was his understanding at the time of sentencing. However, that's not what the state told him when he was released from prison.
Okay. So, and that's where the error comes in, yeah?
Correct.
Okay. So, but as he was sentenced and as he spent his time in prison, he knew that there was approximately 240 days that he needed to spend inside. And so when he came out of prison, he knew he'd been in prison in actual confinement for less than 240 days. He knew that, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And so can we not presume that having been lawfully sentenced, can we not presume that he understands he is under an obligation to spend 240 days in confinement?
That would be true if he wasn't informed by numerous people within the executive branch that his sentence had run. I mean, at the time that he's sentenced, yes, he has an expectation of 240 days.
Yeah.
However, there were intervening events, the error that falls on the state. So realistically, at that point, that 240 days isn't necessarily his expectation.
Okay. So then to agree with you, would we need to conclude that the executive branch's error functionally changes the sentence that he was given.
To an extent, I would agree with that, Your Honor. It essentially turns his sentence into a piecemeal sentence where he stays subject to the control of the state for longer than those 8 months that the court ordered.
Assuming that we count days that he's free as being subject to the control of the state.
Well, he was still subject to the control of the state. He may not have been in actual custody, but Dentisi and Risky are very clear that his sentence continued running, so he remains subject to that confinement order.
Yeah, so let's set Dentisi and Risky aside for a moment, just focus on Magnuson. Or tell me whether Magnuson can be harmonized with Dentisi and Risky, right? Because I think you'd probably agree that while he was, once he left prison, before he went to jail, that he was not subject to an escape charge, correct?
Your Honor, I would disagree with that. As I spelled out in my brief, because he remained under Risky, if I can reframe Risky just briefly, the Court of Appeals spoke about a broader principle from Risky. It's not necessarily that he was in custody when he was released through no fault of his own. The idea is that once a defendant is ordered into and commences confinement, the clock keeps running on that confinement unless it's interrupted by escape, violation of the conditions of parole, or fault attributable to the defendant.
Right. I mean, that's an a priori assumption that you're making there. But let's look at his status in between prison and jail. But Magnuson says you don't get sentence credit unless you're subject to an escape charge, right? Escaping your status. What status was he escaping?
So, Your Honor, as I explained in my brief, and following from that language from Risky, at that point, despite the fact that he was not in actual custody, he remained subject to that order for confinement. The letter from the jail in November, in which they followed up with him, they were also of the opinion that he remained subject to that confinement order. So under the elements of escape, he's convicted and sentenced by a court. He is subject to an order for confinement. Although he's erroneously released, if there's any point where the state makes a show of its authority and says, let's say in that November letter that he received, if he doesn't call back to the jail or if he doesn't comply with a directive from the jail to report immediately, at that point, as listed in Magnuson, he has left that status.
All right. So let's do a little counterfactual then. He leaves prison due to the executive's mistake. The executive 2 weeks later figures out, oh, you know what? He was supposed to go to jail. And so they charge him with escape. What do you say to that?
He would be entitled to credit for that period of time then.
In defense of the charge of escape, what would you say?
I don't think it's a question about whether or not he can be convicted of escape. It's a question about whether or not he can be charged.
Well,
I'm
presuming that our good prosecutors won't bring a charge for which they don't believe they can get a conviction. Yeah? So let's say our good prosecutors come to Mr. Friedlander and say, good sir, you are under arrest for escape. And he says, escape from what? What would you tell him that he had escaped from?
If I'm the prosecutor?
If you're the defendant.
What would you tell the defendant?
He gets charged, comes to the court, and you're the defense counsel on this charge of escape, and you say to the court, how can you say he escaped? What status are you saying that he escaped from? What would your defense be to that escape charge?
I'm not sure I recall the exact facts again, Your Honor, but regardless, he would remain subject to an order for confinement from the court
You're missing my question, because that's what I'm trying to get at, right? So what is it that the process – so Mr. Friedlander has left prison. He's out wandering about doing his thing, enjoying being free, and the police come and they pick him up and they say, you've escaped and we're charging you for escape. You're appointed counsel for Mr. Friedlander. I would imagine you're going to come to court and say, what are you talking about escape? He didn't escape any status. He was free.
Your Honor, I would agree with that, but that is different from the facts that I alleged or discussed in my brief and what I mentioned here today. The question is not I'm not alleging that when he was out after he had been released from prison, that at that point he could have been charged with escape. And that's not what Magnuson says. It says you could be charged with escape for leaving that status. So hypothetically, the state would then have to make some show of authority while he is out and subject to that order.
That brings up Judge Fine's dissent in Dentisi, where he says, how can you be charged for escape from freedom? Right? I thought that was a good question. How do you get charged for escape from freedom?
Well, again, Your Honor, I would emphasize that that is the dissent. So he was in the minority in that case. And when you look at the way that
it doesn't change my question, though.
Okay. Yeah. When you look at the way that the Magnuson court analyzed whether or not somebody is subject to an escape charge, really the heart of that was to try and acknowledge evolving ideas of custody. And we're not really talking about a new idea of custody here. We're talking about a common law principle that's 100 years old. And so when you get down to the question of charging somebody with escape, it really breaks down to those elements that I spelled out in my brief.
Under your logic, then, if someone's on probation and they're given no condition time, they should receive credit for every day that they're on probation?
No, Your Honor, because there would be no order under 97304 under which they'd be subject to.
They're still subject to some control by the state. Why not?
Correct, but my argument had to do with being subject to that order under 97304 for conditional jail time.
Well, where's the conditional jail time here?
In Mr. Friedlander's case?
Right.
The 8 months that was ordered in April of 2016.
Right, but he didn't serve it. I mean, that was concurrent with the time he was serving at Oshkosh, right? And
correct.
They just happened to let him out of Oshkosh early on the other sentence that he was serving in prison. This was condition time for a different sentence. The condition time was to run concurrent with the sentence he was currently serving in Oshkosh. They let him out of Oshkosh.
So he served 165 days of his conditional jail time concurrent to his prison sentence.
Right. And he was accidentally released.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. So how, when he's accidentally released, is he still in custody? That's really another way of asking the same thing.
Well, again, it gets to what the court did in Magnuson, again, acknowledging this evolving concept of custody. It's not limited to actual custody. The statute differentiates between actual custody and custody.
Hey, give me your best example of when someone is not subject to, it's one thing if you're on Huber, you don't report back timely, right? Then you got a problem with the escape issue. Even though you were at liberty, you weren't at liberty for as long and wherever you want for as long as you'd like. You still would be subject to certain conditions. Give me an example of how you would receive credit for being in custody when there aren't limitations placed on that freedom, like a Huber release, for example, or home detention, or something where you are constrained and they can bring you back in any time, or limit that release anytime they want. I mean, that's where you still have that tether to the government, where the government can pull you back in any time. Hence, if you don't follow their rules, you've breached the you could have consequences for that failure, and you could be charged potentially with escape, right? So where's the thing that links you to that breach so that you could be charged for escape when you are completely at liberty and the government doesn't tell you at all, like when you have to report, where you have to report, what you're entitled to do, what time you have to be back, those kinds of things. Help me with that, because that's where you're missing me a little bit.
Well, again, Your Honor, if we go back to Dentisi, with those facts, they analyze it under the context of being temporarily outside of the institution for some other purpose.
Kind of like Huber.
Yes, right? Like Huber. And if you're erroneously given Huber, let's say while you're on probation, and you're there and you escape, then at that point I think you would be subject to an escape charge.
Because you don't show up. You know, it's 8 o'clock, you're supposed to be back, you don't show up at 8, guess what? That's escape. Where was that kind of constraint on his liberty such that we'd know? You don't show up at 8 o'clock, subject to escape charges.
In this case, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Well, again, with this case, it's pretty simple. It's the fact that his conditional jail time continued to run. The mistake of the state doesn't sever the fact that he's subject to it. And there's case law that clearly says that because the statute doesn't use actual custody, he's not required to be in actual custody while subject to that probation order, that he is subject to it. And we have this case law from Risky and Dentisi that says that sentence, that the time he's serving is not severed unless there's a mistake or fault on his part.
Let me see if I have the facts right. When he was sentenced, it was to begin, sentence from the judge was to begin that day to run concurrent with his prison sentence. His prison sentence ended, and the jail folks had previously put a detainer on him, and the error was not in releasing him from prison early, but not arranging transport. Is that
That's correct, Your Honor.
Are here. Then upon release, he did promptly go see his probation officer, and he saw his probation officer several times during this period, and his probation officer never told him about going to jail upon release, or that the jail folks had a detainer out on him, or that the Department of Corrections had made a mistake in not transporting him. So then how was it, if the record reflects, how was it that someone from the Sheriff's Department a couple of months later realized he was out and they didn't have him? As I understand it, the Sheriff's Department then called the probation officer. The probation officer said, hey, call the Sheriff's Department, which the defendant immediately did. And then there were additional concerns.
Your Honor, if I can just briefly rephrase. So it was, how did the Sheriff's Department become aware of the fact that he was not transported?
Does the record reflect that?
I believe the record shows, and I'm not sure why exactly Child Support was looking into this, but it was County Child Support that alerted the Sheriff's Office.
Well, he had lots of problems, didn't he, then? You know, it seems to all rain, you know, in people's parades. Okay.
So, Your Honors, I'd like to emphasize that this common law principle has withstood interpretation for over 90 years, and it was first recognized by the Wisconsin Supreme Court in 1884. It was then recognized by the Attorney General's office in 1925.
Well, what do we do with the statute that says we have no common law crimes after the enactment of the criminal code? What do we do with that statute?
Well, Your Honor, I point your attention. I didn't get a chance to cite this in my brief because it was in the state's reply brief, but there is an argument that when a statute is in derogation of the common law, it is to be strictly construed.
Well, but we don't have in the civil common law a statute that says there are no more civil common laws. But in the criminal code, we do have a statute that says there are no more common law crimes. That's very different. I'm concerned about the statute because I believe we have to do what the legislature says when it says something.
Well, Your Honor, I would note that after the sentence credit statute was passed, Risky and Dentisi were decided, and the legislature never made any express or clear intent to abrogate those holdings. If I can, I would argue that, as I argue in the second part of my brief, that these two things coexist, but they kind of exist outside of different boxes. I know that's about as clear as mud, but 973.155, as indicated in Magnuson, really has to do with pre-trial, pre-confinement, and pre-sentence custody. They talk a lot about acknowledging these evolving ideas of custody. And we're talking about a principle that extends back almost 90 years. And it's not so much that when you are at liberty through no fault of your own. You're in custody. It's really just that your sentence keeps running.
Now, your client has already served the full 75 days. So the only effect our decision could have, if we agreed with the Court of Appeals, is if your client violated the terms of probation, got reincarcerated, he could argue he has another 65 days coming to him, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. It's technically sentence credit for a hypothetical sentence that he may never serve.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yep. So again, if I could reframe briefly, the idea being that his sentence continues running. So when his judgment of conviction shows 8 months and he is at liberty through no fault of his own, he's entitled to that credit as time served, because he is at liberty through no fault of his own. He then, on December 11th, serves an additional 65 days. At that point, then, that's where we would ask for the additional credit, is the 65 days beyond the time he already served on that 8-month sentence.
Do we need to overrule Magnuson then?
No, because the 65 days that he was in after December 11th is he would be in custody of an actual institution, and would therefore meet the criteria for being in custody, and therefore subject to sentence credit.
Do we have to overrule Risky?
No, Your Honor. It would be our request that the baseline rule from Risky remain good law, and that this court order what Risky ordered, which was that a defendant should receive credit for time served when he's in court-ordered confinement and released from actual custody through no fault of his own.
Did Risky rely on statutory interpretation at all, or was it totally on the equitable principle?
Well, Your Honor, it's somewhat challenging because the state did concede that he was entitled to that credit for the time between when he was released and when he was supposed to return.
I understand that in Risky, the state conceded
but
that.
But primarily they...
But the opinion itself, did it rely on the statute or discuss the statute or only the equitable principle?
Well, the statute it relied on was a different statute. It was the statute that said that a sentence is running unless you are unlawfully at large. It relied on that statute, but it was primarily on the common law and said that 973.157 codified the common law.
Are we talking about a common law crime here or a common law principle that you're asking us to embrace?
We're talking about a common law principle. And that's where I go back to my argument about the derogation of common law. It's not a common law crime here. This is a principle in the common law that dates back almost 90 years.
Will you help me understand how both Magnuson and Risky can sit side by side? I know the Court of Appeals found that, and I'm having a hard time reconciling that. How would you figure out what standard to apply, Risky or Magnuson?
Well, I think the easiest way for the two to exist is to understand that when we're talking about somebody who's at liberty through no fault of their own, it's not a question of in custody and it's not a Magnuson question. It's really, were they at liberty through no fault of their own?
So Magnuson questions would only be those where you didn't have the issue of whether there was a fault involved? I mean, aren't they always going to involve the same individuals? Cases involving Magnuson and those involving Risky?
Well, again, when you follow the roadmap that Risky provided, there was no express mention to the credit statute, and I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that they don't necessarily need to butt heads at all. They can coexist because in one case we're talking about, again, somebody who's in pretrial or pre-sentence confinement, and another person who's out, who's already had their sentence or sanction issued, they're subject to the state's control, and then through no fault of their own, they're released. And this state has recognized for a long time that part of the idea behind confinement credit is that no person should have to serve more time than that to which he's sentenced. So if under Risky your sentence keeps running despite the fact that you're released through no fault of your own, if Risky or Dentisi are abrogated in that regard, then we're essentially allowing the state to extend a sentence beyond the time that's ordered in a piecemeal fashion, or, I mean, ultimately what might amount to bad time for no bad conduct.
Maybe I misunderstood you. Did you say that Magnuson didn't reference
the sentence credit statute?
If I said that, Your Honor, that was an error. I meant that Magnuson did not reference Risky at all, despite the fact that Risky had been the law for 13 or 14 years at that point in time. I'd also like to revisit an argument that the state made with regard to the actual length of time that he was out and at liberty through no fault of his own.
Before you do that, I want to follow up on Justice Gallet's question. I have a hard time understanding, even in your response that you just gave, so I'm asking you to maybe shift gears and say it a little differently. I'm having a hard time understanding how you can reconcile Magnuson with Dentici.
Your Honor, I would concede that part of Dentici maybe took an unnecessary step by trying to fit essentially a square peg into a round hole. I think that Dentici could have followed the rule that Risky applied and stopped there.
Which is the equitable principle. Instead, Dentici goes on to do some statutory interpretation.
That's correct, Your Honor. So
the answer to my question is, how do you reconcile Magnuson with Dentici, even though we both agree what it did and what it didn't do, but how do you reconcile them?
Well, I think as I spelled out in my brief, they are reconcilable. It's not the cleanest approach to reconciling the two, but I think that further shows that the way to reconcile them is to essentially split them off into their component parts and say, we've got a clear rule from Risky here.
I read that and I heard the response. It does sound like the square peg in a round hole, sort of, rather than the two boxes. And there's a lot of tension going on there in trying to reconcile them. That's what Dentici tried to do, and that's the part that both of you and I agree that maybe was a little soft.
So then at that point, I think the way that you reconcile them is you reaffirm the ruling in Risky and say that when you are dealing with an individual who is at liberty through no fault of their own, that an individual who's ordered into confinement, that sentence continues running unless they place some fault in their release from that confinement if it's early. So if I could rephrase that, defendant should receive credit for time served when he's in court-ordered confinement and released from actual custody through no fault of his own. That would be the principle from Risky that would be easy to apply. We wouldn't need to go into a Magnuson analysis every single time this happens, which admittedly since 1989, we've seen it a handful of times. So it's not something that's going to suddenly create a windfall for defendants who are ordered into confinement because this really just applies to the circumstances where there is an error on the part of the state.
I'm still not clear on how you're squaring Risky with Magnuson. Because if Magnuson creates the bright line rule that you have to be subject to an escape charge to get sentence time, that's not the same thing as a sentence just continuing to run under the Risky analysis.
So, Your Honor, if I understand your question correctly, I apologize if I sound like a broken record here, but the idea being that Magnuson applies in a specific set of circumstances, most commonly the broad set of circumstances, and the principle from Risky applies in these limited cases where there is an error on the part of the state, and under the common law principle, the defendant is entitled to have that credit.
Presumably, because Magnuson is the Supreme Court and Risky is Court of Appeals, presumably we knew about Risky when we decided Magnuson, right? And in Magnuson, we didn't carve out an exception. And in fact, what we were trying to do was create a generally applicable rule that creates a bright line, and that's the one that we came up with. It doesn't seem to have any room for the continuation of Risky. How do you import Risky back into, how do you make Risky, a court of appeals opinion, carve a niche out of a subsequent Supreme Court case?
Your Honor, I see my red light is on. May I answer the question?
Yeah, if you can do it briefly.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I would just note that Magnuson did a very detailed analysis of confinement credit principles and cases interpreting the sentence credit statute, and it made no mention of Risky. So I think that supports an argument that the two, again, don't exist within the same universe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with Risky, there are two problems with Risky. First, that it didn't mention the statute in its analysis. And second, now, as Justice, you've just pointed out, it's not consistent with Magnuson, and it does not coexist comfortably with Magnuson. I think for the standard in Magnuson to mean anything, an escape charge would have to be able to survive a notice challenge. So to say that there should be some sort of lower standard for whether an escape charge could lie for determining sentence credit below whether an actual charge would lie, I don't think is reasonable. I don't think that's what this court had in mind in Madison. I would add too that there seems to be a concession here that it's only when November 11th comes around, when the state exerts some sort of authority, that Friedlander might be possibly entitled to credit. So I think that it's undisputed that from his release on September 27th to November 11th, there were no restraints that were placed on him, no conditions. And I would argue that there's nothing in the record to establish that there were any conditions placed on him until perhaps the day before the hearing, which is when he learned about it, according to the record. So I don't think that there's any way that he would be entitled to credit under Magnuson for that reason. There's been a reference here to this being a common law principle in Wisconsin law, dating back to an 1884 decision in R.E. Crow. That is not a part of Wisconsin's common law. It didn't establish a rule. In fact, the court explicitly stated that it was not deciding the question and was and declared it to be dicta, as I explained in my brief. So it doesn't survive the 1955 adoption of the criminal code. I would agree with Justice Bradley that this is a rule and not a criminal statute, not a crime. But when the criminal code was adopted in 1955, the statute said that the only thing that survives, only those rules that are not abrogated by the statute survive. So in 1978, when the legislature came up with a comprehensive statute addressing sentence credit, the opportunity to adopt a rule like was adopted in Risky no longer existed.
I noted in your brief you said the 1884 case was dicta, and in fact it indicated dicta, but I also know our general rule is that if it's in our opinion, there is no such thing as dicta. So
that's an excellent point.
And you know, you probably helped write that in your ute.
Well, I think what's different here is that the court actually said that it was dicta.
No,
there's no analysis involved here. The court doesn't have to look at it and say, well, this is a statement of the court, and so it has the same force. The court in 1884 was saying, this is dicta, so I think that this court should respect that.
That's an easy way for us to get rid of an opinion we don't like.
Yeah, it's kind of like the court saying, you know, this is dicta, but we're going to say it anyway because we really think it's, you know, good stuff, but it's dicta because it's not necessary to resolve the question.
Right, right. Well, it was kind of modest of the court to do that, you know. I mean, it really wanted to say what it wanted to say, but then it said it was dicta, so.
Okay.
Yeah, well, maybe it was afraid of its holding and wanted to keep it limited.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Probably correct. I think, too, that what's clear is that the position of Mr. Friedlander now is that we should have two rules when it comes to sentence credit. We should have a rule under Risky and Dentici that is a common law rule that must survive, and then we'll have a separate rule for every other kind of sentence credit case. I think that creates bad precedent. I think it would encourage the creation of other individual rules that courts would have to apply in individual cases. I think that, as I was saying, sentence credit is hard enough already for courts to apply, which is why this court came up with a clear bright line rule in Magnuson. And that bright line rule makes it a lot easier to administer the statute. I see that my red light is on.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you both for fine arguments. We are going to adjourn now for the day. The court will meet in closed conference at 10 minutes past 3 o'clock. We are adjourned.